Hello, my name is Manisha Palta, and I'm an associate professor at Duke University. And I will be completing the second half of the GI cancers, focusing on lower GI cancers, and this talk is entitled The Old School and the New Kids on the Block. Here are my disclosures. I'm employed by Duke University. I receive research funding from both Varian Medical Systems and Merck, have previously received an honorarium for Oakstone CME, continue to work as a section editor and author for UpToDate, and have received consulting fees from Navigant. So, the learning objectives today are twofold. The first is to understand the available literature to guide treatment decisions in the management of lower GI malignancies. We'll discuss both rectal cancer as well as anal cancer. The second will be to develop techniques in simulation, treatment planning, and treatment delivery to optimize radiotherapy delivery and minimize associated toxicities. The presentation outline. So, first, we'll start with a review of anatomy and staging. We'll discuss rectal cancer. The old school topics will be early stage rectal cancer, the role of TME and radiotherapy with TME, neoadjuvant therapy, and concurrent chemotherapy with radiation. The new school topics will be short course RT alone versus long course chemoradiation, total neoadjuvant therapy, which is termed TNT, as well as non-operative management and the omission of radiotherapy. From there, we'll talk about anal cancer, focusing on the current standard of care as well as the interval to assessment of response. And we'll conclude the session by focusing on techniques for simulation and treatment planning. So, to review the anatomy of the lower pelvis and the anus and the rectum in particular, so what you can see here is that the anal canal is the distal aspect, typically 3 to 4 centimeters in length. It is characterized by squamous epithelium pathologically and keratinizing epithelium. And above that marker of 3 to 4 centimeters, you have the dentate line, which represents the transition from squamous epithelium to more glandular tissue. And so in the rectum itself, we typically see adenocarcinomas pathologically. In terms of treatment, the treatments are often dictated not so much by the location of the malignancy, but rather the histology, so that squamous cells, which are typically in the anal canal, are treated with definitive chemoradiation, and adenocarcinomas that are typically in the rectum are treated with neoadjuvant therapy, often chemoradiation followed by resection. There are slightly different patterns of lymphatic drainage for the two malignancies. So, for the rectum itself, we typically see nodal drainage into the pararectal nodes, the sacral nodes, and then the internal iliacs, illustrated here in green. And when we see anal cancers, it is those nodal areas that I mentioned, in addition to the external iliacs here, as well as the deep and superficial inguinal nodes. For rectal cancer staging, there have been a couple of modifications in the AJCC 8th edition. The most notable are which that the M portion of the TNM staging has been subdivided into M1A, B, and C, depending on the metastatic sites. M1A specifically is metastases that are limited to one organ or the so-called oligometastatic state. So on the left-hand side, and this is more for your reference, you can see the TNM staging as well as on the right-hand side the stage grouping. So we'll move into rectal cancer. We'll start with a discussion of early stage rectal cancer. So this includes T1 and 2 node negative cancers. And if you evaluate the NCCN guidelines, there is some discussion on how to manage these patients. So typically, a T1N0 tumor can be managed with local excision alone. Exceptions to local excision are if you have a large tumor that involves more than 30% of the bowel circumference, a large tumor based on size greater than 3 centimeters, if the margins are less than 3 millimeters or very close. If you have a fixed tumor or other adverse pathologic features such as lymphovascular invasion, perineural invasion, poor differentiation, And then if you have SM3 or submucosa layer 3 invasion compared to SM1 or 2 invasion, which might be much more appropriate for local excision. In the NCCN, if you look at T2N0, what is recommended is an LAR or an APR, including a TME. And that local excision can be considered for those patients, particularly after a good response to chemoradiation, and we'll talk a little bit about that going forward. So what is total mesorectal excision? So total mesorectal excision is a surgical technique that involves removing the rectum as well as the surrounding pararectal fat. So you can see a cartoon illustration here on the left-hand side where the entire circumference of the rectum is removed as well as all this adjacent pararectal fat, particularly this mesorectal area here that extends all the way down to the dentate line, and you can see that this is a potential area of tumor deposits. So when an appropriate TME is performed, what you typically see is a specimen that looks very much akin, and my residents shriek at this, but it looks like a pork tenderloin. And if there is a less than TME or an intramucosal or intramesorectal excision, you'll see some irregularities of the mucosa here. And the reason why we know this is important is there's some data looking at a trial which mandated the use of TME. And even though a TME was mandated in this clinical trial, what you can see from these data is that only about 50% of the time was it actually performed. And you can see that depending on the extent of resection and the quality of the surgical resection, it does, or that is number, the quality of the surgical resection is associated with the rates of local recurrence. And you see much lower rates of local recurrence if in fact a total mesorectal excision is performed. So there are data looking at the role of chemoradiation after local excision for early stage rectal cancers. And there are two prospective trials, so note that these are not randomized trials. RTOG 9802 treated T1 favorable lesions with local excision alone, and what they saw was that local recurrence rates were relatively low at 4%. For T2 and T3 tumors, those were treated with local excision followed by adjuvant chemoradiation. And even despite local excision with the addition of adjuvant chemoradiation, what was seen was local recurrences in the neighborhood of about 20%. This is similarly mirrored in a larger prospective trial, the CALGB 8984, which prospectively took T1 tumors, treated those with local excision alone. You can see recurrences there were less than 10%. However, for T2 tumors that were treated with local excision and the combination of chemoradiation, that the local recurrence was again in the neighborhood of about 20%. More recently was a that was performed by the French, which is the GRECAR 2 trial. So it accrued patients between 2007 and 2012. And it was 148 patients who were randomized after they had chemoradiation up front. These were all T2, T2-3 tumors. They were all low-lying rectal cancers that were less than 4 centimeters in size. And patients could only be randomized if they, in fact, had less than or equal to 2 centimeters of residual tumor. And so this is what characterized a good response. From there, patients were then randomized to either TME or local excision. And the study was primarily powered for local recurrence, but they also looked at other endpoints such as metastatic disease, overall survival, cancer-specific mortality as well. And out of 186 patients who were enrolled, 148 were, quote, good responders and were then randomized. The chemoradiation in this trial was 50 gray in 25 fractions with concurrent 5-FU-based chemotherapy, and surgery was performed approximately 8 weeks after chemoradiation. For those patients who had a local excision, the surgical resection margins were attempted to be at least 1 centimeter. So with 5 years of follow-up, what the study showed is that the local recurrences were exceedingly low with either TME or local excision after chemoradiation, at about 7% in both arms. There were no difference in metastatic disease. There was no difference in overall survival as well. So perhaps for select patients who have low-lying tumors, who receive chemoradiation and have a good response to therapy, this may be a subgroup of patients that can be treated with local excision rather than radical resection, which in many of the cases for these low-lying rectal cancers would result in an APR and a permanent colostomy or ileostomy. So what is the role of radiotherapy, particularly in the TME era? And this is referring to more advanced tumors. So the Dutch rectal cancer study was evaluating the role of preoperative radiotherapy in the era of TME. And this was a randomized trial that included 1,800 patients, all of whom had resectable rectal cancer. The inferior margin of the tumor had to be less than 15 centimeters from the anal verge. The tumor had to lie below S1, S2, and there had to be no evidence of metastatic disease. The trial was powered for local control, and patients were randomized to upfront TME alone versus pre-op RT 5 gray times 5, so 5 fraction regimen, and then TME within 10 days. The initial follow-up for this study was 2 years, and at 2 years, what they saw was that the addition of preoperative radiotherapy did reduce local recurrence. And with 10 years of follow-up, we continue to see a persistent benefit in terms of local recurrence. One important thing to note from this study is that there was a significant percentage of patients who were early stage cancers, because it did include not just locally advanced, but all resectable cancers. But despite that, continued or maintained benefit for pre-op radiotherapy in the TME era. So what is the role of neoadjuvant therapy compared to adjuvant therapy? So the study that defines the role of neoadjuvant therapy is the German rectal cancer study, now well over a decade old. This is 800 patients, all of whom have resectable rectal cancer, less than 75 years of age, and no evidence of metastatic disease. Modern staging was with EUS was used, so not an MRI staged group of patients, and all patients had a total mesorectal excision. So in this trial, patients were randomized to pre-op chemoradiation 50-40 centigray with concurrent 5-FU, or they received surgical resection and then post-op chemoradiation to a total dose of 55-80. And follow-up for this trial was approximately 4 years. So the initial trial results illustrated here on the left show that the rate of local recurrence in the post-op arm was 13% compared to 6% in the pre-op arm, so a statistically significant benefit. Even with long-term follow-up at 10 years, there was a persistent benefit in the patients who received preoperative chemoradiation, with this gold line compared to postoperative chemoradiation. For those who like this in numbers, you can see that here. At 5 years, a reduction in local recurrence from 13% to 6%, a persistent benefit even at 10 years. No differences across the board in terms of disease-free survival, distant metastases, or overall survival. So what is the appropriate concurrent chemotherapy to use with radiation? So a more recent trial has attempted to define what this concurrent chemotherapy regimen should be. The NSABP R04 study was a large four-arm randomized trial with 1,600 patients, all of whom had clinical stage 2 or 3 rectal cancer. And patients were randomized to receive one of four concurrent chemotherapy regimens, either 5-FU with or without oxaliplatin, and then the second was second group of chemotherapies was capecitabine with or without oxaliplatin. And the primary endpoint for the study was looking at local regional tumor control. So for the 5-FU capecitabine arm, essentially what they saw was no difference in local recurrence. You can see that across the board here in terms of local regional recurrence, no difference, no difference in disease-free survival, no difference in overall survival. In terms of the addition of oxaliplatin, There was no benefit seen in this trial with the addition of oxaliplatin either. There have been a number of additional studies that have also looked at the question of whether or not 5-FU-based chemotherapy with the addition of oxaliplatin in the neoadjuvant setting is beneficial. And in addition to the NSAVP-R04 study, which I mentioned here, no difference in terms of local regional recurrence. Across the board, many studies have shown no difference in local regional recurrence, perhaps some increased toxicity with the addition of the oxaliplatin. The only study to have contrary results to this is a German rectal cancer study that looked at the addition of oxaliplatin as well. But the overwhelming data supports that oxaliplatin should not be incorporated into the neoadjuvant chemotherapy regimen. So now we'll transition into the new kids on the block. The first topic here is to discuss short course radiotherapy versus long course chemoradiotherapy. I'm not sure how new this is, since many of the early randomized studies in rectal cancer incorporated a 5-gray × 5 regimen. However, in much of North America, the most common approach is neoadjuvant chemoradiation rather than short course radiotherapy. So just to review, short course radiotherapy is 25 gray given in 5 fractions without chemotherapy. Most of the early trials involved immediate surgery, though this role of immediate surgery is evolving. And in general, when surgery was administered earlier, there was no change in the pre-op stage. And we'll talk about some data of potential change in pre-op stage with delayed surgery and short course radiotherapy. It's lower cost because it's delivered quicker, typically associated with excellent compliance because it's just a 5-fraction regimen. And then there's some question about whether or not there's less acute toxicity. So we'll contrast that to long course chemoradiation, which a la the German rectal cancer study is typically 50-40 gray with concurrent chemotherapy. In that situation, surgery is typically delayed on the order of 6 to 8 to 12 weeks or more. There's typically downstaging associated with this approach, as well as about a 20% pathologic complete response. Oftentimes, patients can be converted because of this downstaging, and those that could not have a sphincter-sparing surgery are then able to have one. There's some question about whether or not there's improved late effects. Much of the watch and wait or non-operative management approaches incorporate long course chemoradiation, so we'll also discuss that as well. So what are the trials that define short course compared to long course? So one of these studies is the Australian Intergroup Study, and this was a 320-patient randomized study that looked specifically at clinical T3 patients. They could be N1 or N2. They all had to have tumors less than 12 centimeters from the anal verge and a relatively reasonable performance status. And the primary endpoint for this study was looking at 3-year local control. The short course radiotherapy arm would be deemed acceptable if it was within a difference of 15 versus 5%. So if we compare that to the German rectal cancer study, that's actually quite a significant difference in local recurrence. However, that is how the statistics or the study was powered. Patients were randomized to either pre-op radiotherapy, 5-gray × 5, with surgery within 7 days and adjuvant systemic therapy, or they received pre-op chemoradiation, 50-40 centigray, with concurrent chemotherapy, surgery within 4 to 6 weeks, and then an additional 4 cycles of adjuvant systemic therapy. And the median follow-up for this study was approximately 6 years. And the results showed that in terms of 3-year local recurrence, which is what the study was powered for, that there were no statistically significant differences between the short course arm and the long course arm. So just note that this is a truncated curve, that this up here is only 10% and 0%. So you can see that there is maybe some magnified difference, but we're talking about approximately 5.5% versus 7.5%. There were no differences that were seen in distant recurrence, relapse-free survival, or overall survival. And subsequent quality of life analyses have been performed from this study. So take-home message from here is that there's no difference in local recurrence rates between the short course arm and the long course arm. In a more advanced patient population, the Polish 2 study took 540 patients, all of whom had fixed T3 or T4 cancers, so technically unresectable, less than 75 years of age with a good performance status, and the primary endpoint for this study was looking at the rate of R0 resection. Patients were randomized to pre-op RT, which was 5 gray times 5, followed by 4 cycles of FOLFOX, and this was all before surgery, or they received pre-op chemoradiation. What is lovely about this trial is that the time from initiation of chemorads to the time of surgery was a median of about 12 weeks in both arms, so that variable of time goes away in this trial. And some interesting results. So what we see is what I mentioned previously, is there didn't seem to be a reduction in toxicity with the short course arm. Again, the short course arm got short course followed by some systemic therapy. In addition, at least in terms of the primary endpoint, looking at R0 resection rate, no difference in R0 resection rate when you compared short course RT followed by chemo with long course chemo radiation. And then the initial publication, there did seem to be a difference in overall survival. However, in the updated analysis with at least a minimum of 5 years of follow-up or median of 5 years follow-up, what we see is that that survival difference between the two arms starts to close and that those confidence intervals actually overlap. So no difference in overall survival, but perhaps suggesting that short course radiotherapy followed by systemic therapy may also be a reasonable approach as well. So the Stockholm 3 study was also evaluating short course and long course. This was a randomized trial that did take quite a bit long period of time to accrue patients, 840 in total, all of whom had resectable pancreas cancer. And this was all less than 15 centimeters from the anal verge. The primary endpoint for the study was local recurrence, and patients were randomized to one of three arms. Two of the arms were pre-op radiotherapy, 5 gray times 5. One involved surgery more immediately, within 7 days. The second was short course radiotherapy followed by surgery within 4 to 8 weeks. And then the final arm was a long course arm. However, it was just pre-op radiotherapy alone. There was no addition of concurrent chemotherapy in this arm. And surgery was similarly delayed at 4 to 8 weeks. So what you can see here is that if you're looking at the short course arms, which are the green and the red compared to the blue, that there is no differences seen in local recurrence. So this is on a 0 to 100 scale. This is magged up. No differences across the board in terms of local recurrences. However, what they did see is that there did seem to be a slight difference in post-operative complications when patients received short course radiotherapy and immediate surgery. So this is 53% had any post-operative complication. However, there didn't seem to be such a high rate with short course radiotherapy followed by delay, where it was 41% had any post-operative complication. And there was a significant difference between those two arms, suggesting perhaps that with short course, that a delayed operative approach may be better to mitigate some of these complications or surgical complications. So total neoadjuvant therapy, or TNT. So the traditional approach to neoadjuvant therapy would be to give chemoradiation followed by surgery and then adjuvant systemic therapy. The idea with total neoadjuvant therapy is to move this adjuvant chemotherapy sooner in the treatment algorithm so that it precedes the operation. And there are obviously two ways of giving these modules. So it could be either chemo followed by chemoradiation and then surgery, or an approach of chemoradiation, chemo, and then surgery. Of, as you can see here, 6 cycles of modified FOLFOX, the pathologic complete response rate increases to nearly 38-40%, and that is statistically significant. So this is a technique, or this idea of TNT is being evaluated. There are a number of randomized trials that are incorporating this into the treatment algorithms, especially in an effort to lead to a non-operative management approach. One study to mention here that is looking at chemorads and chemoradiation, as well as the addition of chemotherapy, is the RAPIDO study. So this is an ongoing randomized study, 920 patients with locally advanced rectal cancer, less than 1 millimeter from the mesorectal fascia with lateral pelvic nodes. So this is a more advanced patient subgroup. Primary endpoint is time to disease-related treatment, recurrence or failure. And the patients are being randomized to pre-op radiotherapy, 25 gray, 5 fractions, followed by chemo, versus a neoadjuvant chemoradiation approach. Again, so this is looking at a more advanced group of patients, larger number of patients than the Polish 2 randomized study as well. So we talked or briefly mentioned non-operative management. This is the so-called watch and wait approach. And there have been a number of studies, some of which are retrospective, some of which are prospective, that have evaluated this algorithm. So the initial series were published out of Brazil, looking at patients who had a clinical complete response to chemoradiation. And what you can see is that in this select group, they had very high rates of relapse-free survival and disease-free survival. This is mirrored in a publication from the Netherlands, where a high percentage of patients were able to achieve a clinical complete response. And in that subgroup with receiving non-operative management, they had local relapse-free survival and disease-free survival of nearly 80 to 85%. A prospective trial from a Danish group also high rates of clinical complete response and similarly high rates of relapse-free survival. So what we start to see across the board is in those patients who can achieve a clinical complete response, that about 20% develop a recurrence. Oftentimes those recurrences can be salvaged with either a local excision or a total mesorectal excision with either an APR or LAR at the time of recurrence. And so perhaps this is an appropriate approach for a select group of patients. And it is a hot topic that is the subject of many ongoing trials. So Memorial Sloan Kettering has a randomized phase 2 study where patients receive induction chemotherapy, endoscopic exam, and then go on to chemoradiation versus a chemoradiation approach followed by chemotherapy. So again, this is just looking at the sequencing of these different modules. There's similarly a phase 2 study ongoing at the Royal Marsden, as well as in Brazil. Interestingly, if you look at European expert consensus panels, they suggest that patients who do have a clinical complete response to chemoradiation should be offered an option of watch and wait. This is contrasting to many of the guidelines in the US, particularly NCCN, which still consider non-operative management to be the subject of clinical investigation. So moving into the next topic, so this is looking at the omission of radiotherapy. So a lot of these data for omission of radiotherapy are largely based on a pilot study. This was a pilot study at Memorial Sloan Kettering that looked at clinical stage 2 and 3 high rectal cancers, and these were patients who could undergo sphincter preservation, so these weren't APR patients but LAR patients, and they did not have a threatened circumferential radial margin by MRI, so biologically favorable primary tumors. All these patients went on to get FOLFOX with bevacizumab, and it was a group of 32 patients. And what they saw is that a high percentage of patients then underwent resection, and many, all of them had an R0 resection, all of them had downstaging. There was a path CR of about 25%, and in terms of endpoints, there were no local recurrences at 4 years and very good rates of disease-free and overall survival. So the suggestion based on this data was perhaps there's a subgroup of patients who don't necessarily require radiotherapy. And this bore itself out into the idea of doing a randomized trial. So this is the PROSPECT study. This is a study that is looking at patients who have tumors located between 5 and 12 centimeters from the anal verge, so these are not patients with low-lying rectal cancers. These are all patients who a priori are candidates for sphincter-sparing surgeries, good performance status of ECOG 0 to 2, and the preclinical staging has to be either T2 or T3N1 or T3N0. So this does not include T4 tumors. It does not include N2 tumors. So this is a biologically favorable group of rectal cancers, typically higher rectal cancers. Patients are randomized to either the standard arm, which is chemoradiation, followed by TME and adjuvant chemotherapy, or to the experimental arm of upfront FOLFOX. Patients are restaged, and then depending on response, which many patients are going up this algorithm of favorable response, they then go on to TME and more chemo. So this is an arm without any radiotherapy. If patients are to have a poor response to systemic therapy, they then go down the traditional algorithm of chemoradiation, surgery, and then more chemotherapy. So this will be an interesting study to see if radiotherapy can potentially be avoided, again, for high rectal cancers and lower stage overall, even though these are stage 3 or stage 2, but favorable and definitely not T4 or N2 or higher disease. So now that we've finished our review of rectal cancer, we will now transition into the anal cancer subset of this talk. We'll talk about the current standard of care and how that's evolved over time. We'll also spend a little bit of time talking about the interval to assessment of response. So defining the optimal concurrent systemic therapy for anal cancer has been a story of trying to get rid of mitomycin. So this is an older RTOG study, 8704, that looked at the question of with 5-FU, do we really need to give mitomycin? So it's almost 300 patients who were randomized to chemo radiation with 5-FU, chemo radiation with 5-FU mitomycin. And what was seen is that in this cohort of patients, that the complete response rate was relatively higher with 5-FU. However, if you looked at local recurrences, 36% of patients who did not get mitomycin had a local recurrence, compared to 17% of those patients who received mitomycin. So about half the patients, or local recurrence was reduced by approximately half. There was also an improvement seen in disease-free survival. The subsequent RTOG study was attempting to look at the fact of whether or not, okay, could we replace mitomycin with an alternate systemic therapy agent? And so this trial essentially looked at the replacement of mitomycin with cisplatin. In this trial, there was some induction chemotherapy as well, which makes it a little bit dirty in terms of asking two questions. But it was a nearly 700 patient multi-center randomized study with primary endpoint of disease-free survival. And what was seen for disease-free survival is that there was a significant benefit. The ACT 2 study was simultaneously being conducted in Europe. This is a large randomized study as well. 940 patients, again looking at the question of 5-FU mitomycin with concurrent radiation compared to 5-FU cisplatin. This was a 2x2 randomization where a second question was asked related to the use of adjuvant systemic therapy. So for this study, what they saw is that there was no difference in complete response between the two arms, inclusive of mitomycin or cisplatin. In addition, no benefit to any additional adjuvant systemic therapy after the completion of chemoradiation. Perhaps the most interesting part of the ACT 2 study was the evaluation of response post-chemoradiation. And what was interesting in this study is that at 11 weeks, about 426 patients had a CR. However, if you continued to follow patients out through to even 6 months, what you see is that patients continue to have a response to the point of having a complete response up to about 6 months after the completion of chemoradiation. And so 72% of patients who had not achieved a CR at 11 weeks did in fact achieve a CR at 26 weeks, suggesting that we should not be necessarily taking these patients for an APR if they have clinical response at the primary site any sooner than about 6 months. There's some data now to suggest that perhaps if patients are having a response that we should continue to watch them even up to a year. So they should not be deemed a treatment failure and taken to an APR as long as they're having a clinical response. What the trial was looking at, I'm going to go back just a second. So there was a question related to induction chemo versus just concurrent chemo, and then there was a secondary question related to dose. So Act 2 asked the question of adjuvant chemo, suggesting no benefit for adjuvant chemo, and the Accord 3 was looking at induction chemotherapy. And what this showed is that for colostomy-free survival, there was no difference or no benefit to the induction chemotherapy compared to just doing concurrent chemotherapy. But perhaps there may be a suggestion of a benefit for higher doses. Overall, though, in terms of statistical significance, what you can see here is even though there might be a slight separation of those curves, it is not a statistically significant difference. So the primary interpretation of this result is that the dose escalation is in fact a negative trial, but I think it is hypothesis generating that perhaps there is a subgroup of patients who may potentially benefit from dose escalation, and really what is key is defining what that patient subgroup might be. So in terms of the timeline for anal cancer, in the pre-1970s, APR was standard of care. It wasn't until 1970s that the Nigro regimen and this idea of chemo radiation even came to fruition. Since then, in the 90s, in the 2000s, in the 2012s, essentially what we've determined is that you really cannot replace mitomycin with cisplatin, that we shouldn't be giving any adjuvant chemotherapy, and we shouldn't be doing any induction chemotherapy or dose escalation. And so despite decades and decades and decades and decades of ongoing randomized studies, we essentially remain with chemo radiation being the standard of care with concurrent 5-FU and mitomycin. So where are we going from here in terms of future directions? The PLATO study has multiple arms that are quite interesting. So I'll focus actually not so much on this arm here, but on these two arms. So the middle trial is T1, T2 tumors, all of which are less than 4 centimeters in size and node negative. And patients are being randomized in a 2-to-1 randomization to 50-40, which is the standard dose, versus a lower dose of 41-40. So this is a randomized phase 2 study. In the higher stage patients, so T3, T4, and 1 through 3, this is the Act 5 study. It's essentially going to start off as a pick the winner study where you've got 58.8 or 61.6, and that's going to be part of a pilot as well as the phase 2. And whichever is the winning arm here will then be compared to 43, 20, and 28 fractions. So it's essentially a standard dose compared to a dose escalation in patients with higher nodal positivity or higher nodal stage as well as higher T stage. So perhaps what we may see here is the parsing out of a potential benefit of dose escalation in a certain subgroup of patients based on more advanced stage, and perhaps the benefit of or a non-inferiority or similar outcomes with dose reductions in patients who have earlier stage disease. So coming back to our learning objectives, so far we have discussed the available literature to guide treatment decisions and the management of lower GI malignancies. We've talked about rectal cancer as well as anal cancer. And now we'll move in to techniques of simulation, treatment planning, treatment delivery. So for rectal cancer, typical way that I simulate these patients is that I simulate them prone on a belly board. And this is typically the technique I'll use for tumors that are not invading the anal canal. In terms of other instructions, we'll actually tape the buttocks apart to minimize any bolus effect of the radiation. We'll place a marker at the anal verge, I find this is useful to document distance or corroborate distance from the anal verge with what I'm seeing radiographically. We'll often simulate patients with a full bladder. This full bladder in combination with the belly board helps to move much of the small bowel out of the pelvis. I typically do use IV contrast. However, I do not personally use either small bowel or rectal contrast. My rationale, particularly for rectal contrast, is that by injecting rectal contrast, you're artificially distending the rectum, which is going to be different than how the patient's going to be treated every day. And I try to do everything I can at the time of simulation to mirror, in fact, how the patient's going to be treated on a day-to-day basis. One important detail is to make sure that there are sufficient CTV margins to account for rectal distension as well as bladder filling. So if you did daily cone beams, you would see that some patients in particular, their bladder filling can be pretty variable. They can have gas in the rectum that can create rectal distension pretty significant so that their target volumes fall outside of the radiation field. So it's really critical to make sure that you're monitoring that. If you have the ability to do a cone beam CT, that you're doing that to do volumetric assessment as well. In terms of nodal basins to be included within that CTV, the nodes that we think about are the presacral nodes, the mesorectal nodes, as well as the internal iliac. In general, I typically from CTV to PTV do a margin of 7 millimeters, and that is with daily image guidance. I typically do KV imaging daily. I do think that cone beams are useful. I will often do those for the first few days to ensure consistency of the soft tissues, followed by then a weekly cone beam CT. So this just illustrates the positioning of patients. So you can see here, prone, there's a belly board here, buttocks are taped apart. We typically put a marker at the anal verge. So patients are simulated prone, and then this shows you illustrates the treatment fields. So still for most rectal cancer patients at our institution, we're using a 3D technique. I'm still finding that IMRT is challenging to have approved. I also think that in many cases, there's only incremental benefits for IMRT. But you can see here, this is a traditional three-field approach using a PA and two opposed laterals. We'll often use higher energy beams. I particularly like to try to do treat these patients with 10x beam energy. But you'll typically, for these lateral fields, we'll often have to use a higher energy just because there's much more tissue in the lateral direction than, say, in the PA direction. And typically, the field weighting's often 60% through the PA fields with an equal distribution through the lateral fields. I'll only add on an AP field if I'm treating the external iliacs, if you have a case where rectal cancer is invading anterior structures like the prostate, the bladder, the vagina, or in certain situations, patient's body habitus may result in a better dose distribution by a contribution from an anterior field as well. Just keep in mind that by adding an anterior field, you are going to increase the dose to the bladder. One area of CTV consideration that has gotten a lot of press is this area of the lateral pelvic nodes. So these are the obturator nodes. And there was a series that was published from Japan that looked at 1,200 patients, all of whom had T3, T4 disease and a low-lying rectal cancer, less than 8 centimeters from the anal verge. And they looked at regional lymph nodes, and they looked and assessed at whether or not the short axis was greater than 7 millimeters versus less than 7 millimeters in size. And what they saw was that when they assessed these lateral pelvic lymph nodes, if the lymph node was greater than 7 millimeters in size, that seemed to be associated with a much higher rate of local recurrence, as you can see here, compared to lymph nodes that are less than 7 millimeters in size, or perhaps not even visible. And so one thing that we are starting to do in our tumor boards is that we're actually, and even with our radiology colleagues, is we're asking them to comment specifically on the lateral pelvic nodes. And the reason that that's so important is that this is not an area that has typically been resected at the time of surgery. And so at the time of our tumor board discussions about these patients, We very explicitly ask our surgeons if that area of where a node is enlarged, if it's going to be removed at the time of surgery. If it is, we treat with a typical standard dose. However, if it is not intended to be in the typical surgical field of resection, then we've considered giving a boost to these lateral pelvic nodes in an effort to escalate the dose slightly to a definitive treatment type setting. So for anal cancer, immobilization at our institution is slightly different. So we, rather than simulating these patients prone, we simulate them supine in either an alpha cradle or a body fix. There are some data to treating these patients prone. The issue that I have with it is that the reproducibility, especially in terms of things like pelvic tilt, in terms of treating the inguinal nodes, I feel like there's a little bit more uncertainty, especially with the use of IMRT, that my preference is to simulate these patients supine. Similarly, a full bladder to get the small bowel out of the pelvis. I'm always doing IV contrast unless there's a contraindication. I don't think you need oral contrast, but for the small bowel, it could be helpful. There might be certain situations where you would treat them with the legs together if you wanted to ensure that there was a bolus effect at the anal verge. Oftentimes, we'll simulate patients frog-legged in an effort to minimize the skin fold in the inguinal area. But obviously, I think legs together versus frog legs versus slightly apart depends on what the target is and if there's some benefit to creating a bolus effect in the perianal region. We'll often fuse our PET scans with our CT simulation scans. I find that that's helpful in terms of defining the target. We keep our CTV and PTV expansions on the perianal skin so we don't extend them past the body contour. And when we're thinking about nodal areas of involvement, so like rectal cancer, it's the mesorectum, the presacral space, as well as the internal iliacs. However, in this situation, there is also drainage to the external iliacs as well as to the inguinal nodes. So those are included as well in the CTV designation. Similar to rectal cancer, in terms of CTV to PTV margin, I'm expanding my CTV 7 millimeters to arrive at the PTV. In this situation, day one, it may be helpful to just ensure the dose measurements at the anus using either TLD or diodes. If you're using bolus, you can adjust bolus as needed to ensure that you're getting the appropriate dose distribution that you intend to get. And this could also be used in the inguinal area if you have an involved node as well. So, some sort of dosimeter to assess for what the daily dose will be and making any adjustments after the first couple treatments is usually a reasonable thing to consider. So, this illustrates the immobilization. This is an alpha cradle here. You can see the frog-legged position to reduce the inguinal fold in terms of treatment volumes. So, unlike rectal cancer, which would just include the posterior half of this area, because of nodal spread into the inguinals and external iliacs. That's why these areas are part of the CTV as well. I comment that it typically looks sort of like Mickey Mouse. One of the best contouring atlases that I have seen, and I will just provide you the reference for it, this is out of the Australasian group. It was published in the Red Journal back in 2012. The reason why I like it is that it breaks down every nodal station by different color. Has multiple pictures to show you what those nodal levels include, and then has graphs and tables delineating exactly where those nodes start, where they end, what is the lateral and medial extent of all those nodal basins as well. So to summarize target volumes for rectal cancer, for T1 to T3 tumors, typically we're treating the mesorectum, the presacral space, internal iliacs, and then the obturator nodes. And again, these are the lateral pelvic nodes that I mentioned that you just need to pay particular attention to, largely based on that publication in JCO last year from Japan. The upper border for these tumors is going to be L5-S1. If you have T4 invasion, so this is invasion typically into anterior structures, bladder, prostate, vagina, then you're going to also include the external iliac nodes. For an upper rectal cancer, your upper border may be slightly higher. So if you have a tumor that starts in the rectum but extends into the sigmoid, This may be a case where the upper border is a little bit higher than the typical L5-S1 interspace. For rectal cancers that invade the anus, the one additional area to consider are the inguinal nodes. I do have to say that there is a lot of controversy over whether or not the inguinal nodes should be included. Part of that stems from the fact that there have been some institutional series published looking at inguinal nodal recurrences in patients with anal adenocarcinomas, suggesting that the rates of nodal involvement are less than 10% and that they should not necessarily be included in every patient who has rectal cancer invading the anus. But I would say even amongst GI radiation oncologists that the involvement or the inclusion of the inguinal nodes is an area of controversy and hotly debated. I will say for the record that I do not routinely include the inguinal nodes unless there appears to be involvement by imaging, particularly PET imaging. For anal cancer across the board, you're essentially treating everything you treat for rectal cancer and always treating the inguinal nodes as well. In terms of planning constraints, so these are the planning constraints from RTOG 0529. So that was a prospective phase 2 study that looked at the reduction in toxicity seen with IMRT compared to historical control. And so I tend to follow or utilize these constraints in my treatment planning. I tend to actually focus more so on the higher dose constraints and not these lower dose volumetric based constraints. So meaning typically I'm trying to ensure that there's no small bowel above 50 gray. There are certain scenarios where I will treat up to 55 gray as long as it is a small volume, less than 1 or 2 cc's. For femoral heads, oftentimes using this high dose constraint. Similarly, for bladder, using the constraint seen here, typically I would use a median dose of 35 gray, and then similarly for external genitalia, trying to keep the mean dose less than 20 gray. So in summary, so we've discussed old school topics related to rectal cancer. We've talked about early stage rectal cancer. We've talked about the role of radiotherapy, even in the TME era. That local control is improved with neoadjuvant therapy compared to adjuvant therapy, and that concurrent 5-FU with chemotherapy is the standard regimen, and that oxaliplatin does not need to be added to that. In terms of new school topics for rectal cancer, we've talked about emerging data for short course radiotherapy compared to long course chemoradiotherapy. We've talked about total neoadjuvant therapy, non-operative management approaches, as well as some ongoing studies that are looking at the omission of radiotherapy. For anal cancer, pretty straightforward. Standard of care for that disease remains chemoradiotherapy with concurrent 5-FU mitomycin. That patients can continue to have a response to treatment as long as their tumor or primary is regressing for up to 6 months, perhaps even as long as a year after the completion of chemoradiation. And then hopefully you've learned some different techniques and tricks for anorectal simulation, some considerations in terms of CTVs, as well as dose planning constraints. Thank you.